Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. And today, my guest is Dr. Charlie Erickson, professor of oceanography at University of Washington. Charlie has helped change the way the ocean is observed and understood from top to bottom and shore to shore. Dr. Erickson gave the first lecture in the Port Townsend Marine Science Center 2018-2019 lecture series last October. It was called The Future of the Oceans. His talk was titled Swimming Through Swirls, Observing Ribbons and Rings of Ocean Circulation Autonomously. His research group invented the Sea Glider and the Deep Glider underwater vehicles. And I broadcast the first part of the interview with Dr. Erickson first last October. You can hear that on a podcast if you visit the KPTZ website. The first show aired the week of October 17th, and we talked a lot about the Sea Glider and how it has revolutionized the way data can be collected. In the second part, we're going to talk about the basic patterns of ocean circulation and the new things that are being learned. But first, before we go to Dr. Erickson, let's hear this week's mystery sound. As a small hint, you would actually need to be in their breeding areas in springtime to hear this. In the winter, we commonly see them on the Salish Sea, where they feed on submerged prey. We'll come back to the mystery sound later in the program. In observation and news of what's going on in our area, I have a very different kind of observation to share with you today. Port Townsend naturalist Jeff Gibson posted the vignette I'm going to read on a mailing list for Washington birders. That mailing list is called, by the way, Tweeters. So this is taken from Jeff's posting. He calls it a crepuscular phoenix. Last week, I was up at dark o'clock in the morning, as usual, and as the sky to the southeast gradually brightened to a dim twilight, I saw a phoenix flying by the treetops outside my window. I didn't realize we had such around here, but it sure looked like one. Okay, so maybe I've watched too many Harry Potter movies. I have. But a big, long-tailed bird. What else could it be, I thought. A peacock? No, it was flying too high. Plus, I think that peacocks lose their tail feathers in the winter. And besides, I've never heard or seen a peacock in Port Townsend either. So I was inclining my ID towards the phoenix, and I checked it out on the internet. I wasn't going to take Albus Dumbledore's word for it, so I checked the history on Wikipedia and came across Herodotus. Now, Herodotus, who's a Greek historian of the 5th century, had never seen, actually, a phoenix himself, but he heard accounts about it. Apparently, it was supposed to be gold and red in color, while the general make and size are almost exactly that of the eagle. By the way, Herodotus, aka the father of history, did tend to make stuff up when he didn't really know what he was talking about. I imagine he would have loved Wikipedia. Well, it was too dark to see the colors, but the whole eagle thing fit the bill. As often the case, sunlight was the best disinfectant for clearing up my ID ills, as the increasing daylight revealed an actual bald eagle out there. It was trailing a big wad of grass clutched in its talons. The wad, a bit longer than the eagle's body. Even in better lighting, it came off like a tail. So, alas, no phoenix, but pretty cool anyway. Actually, I've seen the eagle hunting grass phenomenon a number of times and always do a double take. It makes me smile. Ever since their return from summer vacation back in mid-October, the eagle pair here have been hauling sticks and grass up to their nest. Busier some weeks than others and really piling on the grass lately. The nesting cycle of renewal, something else eagles represent, along with the phoenix, although no flames are involved. So those were the words of Jeff Gibson, a local naturalist. So now let's go to a phone conversation with Dr. Dr. Charlie Erickson. Well, I'm back with Dr. Charlie Erickson, professor of physical oceanography at the University of Washington. And we talked with Charlie, several weeks ago about the gliders, the sea glider and the deep glider that he and his students and colleagues developed and work with, and how they can take a look inside the ocean to see what's going on, just not from sort of surface observations, but actually go down in the ocean and measure things that help us understand about circulatory patterns within the ocean. So today, we're going to talk about sort of just what are those patterns? What are we learning that's new? So Charlie, just kind of as a broad overview, and I know it would be so much easier if we had a visual here, a map in front of us that we could share with listeners, but just in general, can you describe the patterns of surface circulation?
Okay, since we live at mid-latitude, as oceanographers call it, neither near the equator or near the pole, or somewhere in between, general patterns of surface circulation of the ocean are big gyres that in the northern hemisphere move in a clockwise sense, and they're quite intensified on the western sides of those gyres. So, for example, in the Pacific, there's a current called the Kuroshio that hugs Japan, and it's the most prominent current in the North Pacific, and it streams off to the east of Japan eventually.
It's like the analog of the Gulf Current in the Atlantic.
The Gulf Stream. Mm-hmm. So the Gulf Streams have been known for a long time. I think Benjamin Franklin, when he was postmaster, did a survey of the Gulf Stream and was very interested in it because it had some impact on how fast the mail got back and forth. That's what they were interested in at that point. So there's a fairly broad, diffuse return flow from the Gulf Stream, and it comes back to the western side of the ocean, gathers up in the Caribbean, and comes out through the Florida Straits and hugs the continental shelf, going as far as about Cape Hatteras. And at Cape Hatteras, it suddenly leaves the east coast and heads out to sea. It goes a little bit farther north, but it starts to meander a lot there.
Talk to me a bit about now the analog in the Pacific. You said the Kuroshio goes up the coast of Japan.
Yeah, it goes past Taiwan, and it actually is on the west side of a string of islands before it squirts through a couple of them just south of Japan, some of the smaller Japanese islands on the Izu-Ogasawara Ridge, I think is the name of it, and heads straight out to sea at that point. And then its remnants are referred to as the West Wind Drift, and that water eventually gets over to the west coast of the United States, and we generally have a circulation southward, currents coming southward from where we live in Washington.
And that's what we call the California Current, right?
It becomes the California mm-hmm. Current, and there's a partition that splits off and goes to the north, and that becomes the Alaska mm-hmm. Gyre.
And in the southern hemisphere, similar notion of gyres?
Similar notion, opposite sense. They tend to, the East Australia Current goes to the south along the eastern edge of Australia. There's something called the Agulhas Current and gathers up in South Africa and moves along the coast until it gets to about Cape Town, and then it separates and it actually turns around and back to the east in the Indian Ocean.
And there isn't there a huge sort of continuous current then around Antarctica?
There is a Antarctic circumpolar current, and it's made up of a couple of different fronts, a couple of different jets, but it generally goes all the way around the ocean in one long current. And as I tried to explain in my talk on Sunday, that it's not very continuous. It really exists as a lot of eddies.
In your talk, you also mentioned that there were kind of a couple of different paradigms for understanding these currents. And you also talked about the notion of conveyor belts. Can you just kind of briefly tell us how
Sure.
these views are different and what they tell us about those currents?
Well, what we've talked about mostly about the whole notion of a current is it really is an identifiable piece of ocean that moves in one direction reliably. And the whole point about time variation of these currents is that sometimes they break up and aren't observable very much at all, that they break up into a jumble of eddies, of swirls in different directions. And it used to be thought that most of the world's ocean circulated through these major currents, and now we recognize.
So the major currents would be the pipeline notion that they
the pipeline
go.
Notion.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Correct. And the other notion is that the eddies are diffuse properties well enough that a lot of individual parcels of water don't follow the pipeline at all. They break off from the pipeline and diffuse out into the ocean interior, away from the boundaries.
So that's your sort of sense of the swirlies, all these little
vortexes
spin off. And then there's been some talk about the notion of conveyor belts. Tell us what that means.
The idea of a conveyor belt was put forth by a chemical oceanographer named Wally Broecker from Columbia University Lamont-Doherty Geophysical Observatory. And he tried on the basis of chemical signatures. He said, well, the sense of circulation must be something like this, that there's sinking in the far North Atlantic, and that water eventually makes it its way down the western sides of North America. And,
so that's colder water sinking
to the western side of the ocean, eastern side of North America.
But that's colder water sinking to deeper, sort of below the...
That's right. Quite deep, near the bottom. And that water makes its way southward through the Atlantic all the way to the Antarctic region as it joins the circumpolar circulation. It moves off to the east, south of Africa, south of Australia, and then feeds a circulation in the South Pacific that fills the Pacific. And it upwells at that point, that the sense of circulation is to generally bring water back up to the surface, and that near surface water is thought to go through the Indonesian archipelago and then along the surface across the Indian Ocean from Australia to Madagascar, and then it gets entrained in the Agulhas Current that brings it to the tip of Africa, and then it spins off into swirls and somehow circulates back into the Atlantic, and water goes up the western side of the ocean in the South Atlantic and the North Atlantic, eventually reaching the northern.
So that's the completion of the conveyor belt, up and down.
The conveyor belt.
So you said that was based
on... It's a hand-wavy concept at best.
And you said it was based on some chemical data. Does that really exist?
Some people argue about whether it really exists or not. It's a conceptual framework that is useful in a broad brush.
Tell me now, as we mentioned, last program, we talked a lot about the gliders. What have you been able to learn about currents using your gliders?
One of the fun things that we've managed to learn, particularly with a deep glider, is that we can observe for the first time rather regularly the entire average current in a region from top to bottom. So instead of looking at currents just near the surface, we can make a measurement of current all the way to the bottom, and we can see this mode of variability that's quite prominent but usually not measured. There aren't other measurement systems that do a good job of measuring it.
Depth
average current
at all the different levels, and you can also, from that kind of theory, like the average movement of the water.
That's correct.
That's what you're saying?
We actually do it the other way around.
Okay.
The glider directly measures the depth average current, and then from the signature of water density...
Which is temperature and salinity, right?
Temperature and salinity.
And pressure, I guess.
We can figure out what the currents are at intermediate depths.
So you do it backwards than I was describing. Okay, so now that you have the notion of your average flow and you can figure out currents at different depths, what are you learning from that?
Well, the conventional knowledge of the paradigm that I grew up with was that most of the motion in the ocean was composed of a depth average flow, which, by the way, I just told you we rarely measure, and then sort of the first harmonic of that flow. Think of a violin string and plucking it. You get a note. Well, the same thing is true top to bottom in a stratified ocean. The ocean responds in a series of modes, and the fundamental mode, the fundamental harmonic, if you like, is the only one that most others talk about because it's the only one that they could really measure very easily.
From satellites or from sampling?
From satellites.
The surface, yeah.
That's correct. That fundamental mode makes the sea surface go up and down a little bit. The higher modes, the higher harmonics, make the sea surface go up and down even less. They're down at the noise level of what a satellite can see, so they don't typically get described very much. But they're actually there, and by going down in the ocean and measuring temperature surfaces and watching them go up and down, you can find that, yes, there's measurable energy in these higher wave number or shorter wavelength constituents of the total current field.
And so you're getting a much finer view of what the oceans do.
That's right. And we can see that the swirliness, really I'm talking about vorticity for the aficionados, that's the curl of the velocity field, that swirliness gets transmitted from big eddies to slightly smaller to even smaller to minute eddies only meters across whereas the initial eddies might be hundreds of kilometers across. There's a cascade, a turbulent cascade of transfer of that swirliness. And at the very smallest scales, it eventually gets down to a level where it dissipates and gets frictionally removed from the ocean.
So that's and the that's, swirly current paradigm of thinking about
that's right.
all these
Well, that's part of it, yes.
spin-off
it's ocean
things,
turbulence.
Yeah. I guess I have a question for you. It sounds fascinating. It sounds like you're learning a lot and that our understanding of the patterns of ocean circulation are changing and may well change a lot as we learn more and more. Other than just the thrill of understanding how things work, what's the importance of understanding the patterns of ocean circulation? And I guess it's the why study this stuff question.
It's really easy at one level. If you don't understand how a system works, there's no way you can predict how it's going to work in the future. One of the things we're trying to do is to understand how the ocean works from an observational point of view that allows us to ultimately improve models so that we can predict what the future will be like. And if we can make a model of the ocean, that there are very good models that exist now, but they depend on certain assumptions, and some of those assumptions may or may not be warranted in certain cases, and they may make predictions now that aren't as good as they could be. They might be in error at some point, and we would like to make sure that the models that we have really are as accurate as possible and give us the best chance of predicting future conditions might be.
So my mind immediately goes to predicting future conditions and climate change. And I know this is another huge subject. Is that going to be one of the major outcomes of this better understanding?
I think understanding climate is clearly one of the things that we're after. Climate is basically the sum total of all the weather events that ever happen in the atmosphere. The same thing is true in the ocean climate. So we would like to be able to understand and predict what happens in the ocean on very long timescales mm-hmm. that are longer than a human lifetime, mm-hmm. longer than hundreds of human lifetimes.
But may be significant over the long term.
That's right.
Yeah, to life on Earth.
It also allows us to try and interpret what happened in the past. Figuring out what happened in the past will give us some key as to what will happen in the future. So if our models are good enough, we can predict with some skill what the future is like. So most of what goes on with climate change prediction now is based on having a number of different models that predict almost the same thing, that one of the reasons we have confidence that predictions of global climate change are correct is that a number of different models designed in different ways and with known strengths and weaknesses all predict more or less the same thing.
That is, I think, a good place to end this without going much deeper into climate change and the impacts of climate change and the fact that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just came out with
a report.
Yeah, I think we'll end our conversation of ocean currents there. Thanks again, Charlie. This has been good fun. It makes my mind swirl, too.
Oh, good. My pleasure, too, if shared what we've tried to do in one corner of the field here.
Thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Okay, so it's time to hear the mystery sound again. That was the chatter and calling of bufflehead ducks. These small ducks are visitors to our waters during the winter and are easily identifiable by the male's large, dark head with a brilliant white patch that wraps around the back of the head and a dark back with a white chest and flanks. This distinct coloration makes them stand out even at a distance. The females are a dark brown and have a small white patch on her cheek. Bufflehead dive for aquatic invertebrates, crustaceans, and mollusks. They typically swallow their food while still underwater. While foraging, they spend half of their time underwater, scanned carefully and patiently when you look for them. To dive, bufflehead compress their plumage to squeeze the air out, then give a slight forward leap and plunge powerfully downward. They hold their wings tightly against their bodies underwater and use only their feet to propel themselves. And then at the end of the dive, they just sort of bop up to the surface like a cork. sometimes appearing out of nowhere to a casual watcher, and they can disappear just as fast. Thanks to the Cornell Ornithology Lab website for information and the sound recording. Now let's look forward to upcoming events, and I'm going to ask Alex Henley, who is our sound engineer for the day, to help me out. So, Alex, what's going on?
Well, it looks like it's all happening in February. On February 2nd, Admiralty Audubon is sponsoring its first Saturday Bird Nature Walk at Fort Flagler State Park. It starts at 9 a.m. at the park boat ramp leading to the spit. The walk may also visit the U.S. Coast Guard Fisheries Lab.
That sounds interesting. Well, Saturday, February 2nd is also Groundhog Day. As a reminder, the name derives from the Pennsylvania Dutch superstition that if a groundhog emerging from its burrow on this day sees a shadow due to clear weather and sun, it will then retreat to its den and winter will persist for 6 more weeks. If it does not see its shadow because of cloudiness, spring will arrive early. The tradition actually does remain popular in modern times. Studies have found no consistent correlation between a groundhog seeing its shadow or not and the subsequent arrival time of spring-like weather. This weather lore was brought from German-speaking areas where the badger is the spring forecasting animal. But the folks at Stardate observe that Groundhog Day derives from the ancient pagan celebration of what's called a cross-quarter day. It's the midpoint between winter solstice and the spring equinox. That was meant to be the beginning of spring and better weather.
Birds, birds, and more birds. If you are interested in learning more about our local birds, increase your ability to recognize them, then the beginning birds and birding class being offered this month by the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society may be just the thing. Classes begin the afternoon of Tuesday, February 5th, at the Dungeness River Center Audubon facility. The class will be held every Tuesday in February. You can check the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website for more information.
And the Jefferson County Clemente Course, Finn River Farm and Cidery, and the Jefferson Land Trust are sponsoring another of their Thinking Through the Land series. On Wednesday, February 6th, Ezra Sullivan, who's the Sunfield Farm Manager, will be giving an introduction to biodynamic agriculture. Check the Jefferson Land Trust website for details.
In December of 2018, Nan was lucky enough to interview videographer Florian Grainer.
And it was fun.
And they talked about Eleonora, the giant Pacific octopus, now at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Lucky for us, on the afternoon of February 8th, the Marine Science Center will be opening the doors for Eleonora's enrichment and feeding session. Allie Redman will present Eleonora with several feeding puzzles or toys and watch Eleonora explore her toys and stretch her skills. That is assuming, of course, that she decides to be active that afternoon, as they are rather temperamental.
They are temperamental, but I do have February the 8th on my calendar because
I'm there. I can't wait.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. My thanks to our steadfast editing crew. Today's sound engineer and editor is Alex Henley. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. You can email us at naturenow, that's one word, naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden, in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see. In an octopus's garden, in the shade. We would be warm below the storm, in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed in an octopus's garden near a cave. Because we know